Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Richard Holbrook, U.S. Special Envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, said the Pakistan government's recent efforts to weaken the Taliban represent an important opportunity for new cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistan, a chance to move beyond security concerns. But American journalist Nicola Schmidl, who spent 2 years living in Pakistan, has his doubts. In a new book, he details his experiences there and why he was expelled from the country after 22 months. His new book is called To Live or to Perish Forever. Nicola Schmidl joins me in the studio to talk about living in one of the world's most dangerous countries. We do invite your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to have you here. You begin the book on a very cold, rainy night when you were told to leave Pakistan. Describe that event.
So it was early January. It was 2 days after I had written a story, my first story for the New York Times Magazine called Next Gen Taliban, that profiled this emergent, more dangerous generation of Pakistani Taliban. And the story came out on Sunday. And on Monday, our guard at our house said that intelligence agents had stopped by the house two or three times and had said that I was writing against Pakistan, that our visas had been revoked, and that we were living in Pakistan illegally. And so we, the guard and I, had these conversations just between the two of us, sort of shielded from my wife so that she wouldn't get unnecessarily worried. And I didn't think much of it, thought that this was normal harassment, sort of after you've done something that's controversial, the government following up. And then the next night, when I came back after being out all day, he pulled me aside again and he said, look, the cops have come by four times and they're going to come by again in 45 minutes. And sure enough, five of them standing in the awning of the house where we were renting showed me a deportation order that made it very clear that our visas had been revoked, that we were in fact living in Pakistan illegally, and they told us that we had an hour to leave.
Living in Pakistan illegally, was that your understanding from the time you had gotten there 22 months earlier?
Oh, no, by no means. I had gone there as on a writing fellowship, a two-year writing fellowship from an organization called the Institute of Current World Affairs.
Actually, you thought you were going to Iran, but instead went to Pakistan.
That's right. They originally awarded the fellowship to go to spend 2 years in Iran, and unfortunately, my timing was such that a week after I received the fellowship, Ahmadinejad was elected president. And suddenly the prospects of a 27-year-old American and his new wife wandering around Iran looking at issues of identity and ethnic politics seemed much less plausible than it might have seemed a week earlier. So I went back to the foundation and said, you know, Pakistan is also very interesting. I don't speak any Urdu at this point, but I can go there and learn on the fly. And so they agreed.
And so that's how you got there.
Exactly.
And what kind of connections did you have to make immediately to get yourself started?
Well, it was – I sort of followed a theory almost of concentric circles of networking in that before I left, I had the good luck to meet a former political advisor to the U.S. ambassador who had been working in Karachi, a Pakistani who had been working in Karachi with the U.S. ambassador and was now living in the D.C. area. And he opened up his Rolodex to me about 3 weeks before I left and proceeded to give me this incredible list of contacts that were in Karachi, including people like, I mean, his Rolodex included Hamid Karzai's phone number in Quetta from before 2001. Very well-connected guy. And so I showed up and was sort of already tapped into some of these circles, some of these political parties. And for the next 2 years, just kept using those contacts to inch a little bit further out and a little bit further out and a little bit further out.
Now, did you feel any concern going in about safety? You and your wife were there. I mean, did you have any concerns whatsoever?
I didn't. I might have. Perhaps I should have. I know that the rest of my family did. My wife certainly did not. She was very excited and really very enthused to be going to Pakistan for 2 years. The timing again was such that I left on Valentine's Day, 3 months after we'd been married. So this was the idea of a honeymoon. I left her behind in D.C. I went to sort of get things set up. And this was during the time of these cartoon protests in early 2006 against that were published in the Danish newspaper. And I remember sitting on the Air Emirates flight going from Dubai to Karachi and looking at the screen showing the news for the day. And it said, many die in Pakistani riots over cartoons. And I thought, oh, this is it. I'm going to get there. I look Danish. I'm blonde. You know, for the first time in my whole life, I'm going to immediately get off in a Muslim country and say, no, I'm an American. I'm an American. And I thought that they were going to sort of, you know, rip me to shreds when I got off the airplane. Of course, that didn't happen. Pakistanis proved to be incredibly hospitable, very warm, very welcoming. And it was through them that I eventually, you know, was able to do the work that I did, through their hospitality and generosity.
Now, finding even the most basic ways around without speaking Urdu, with just these contacts, I mean, give us the basics of how you got established.
Well, so I spoke Persian beforehand. I had spent the previous summer in Iran at the University of Tehran, actually. I lived in the dormitories with Iranian students, spent 2 months there, and it was a very, very intensive Persian introduction. 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon, and then all day you have no other choice. People don't speak English in Tehran, so you have no other choice. So after 2 months, I came back, and I had this great base. And a good amount of Urdu borrows from Persian vocabulary and a little bit even from Persian grammar. So I had that. I spoke I had taken a couple of Urdu lessons before I arrived. But I also – there were a couple of friends and contacts who could recommend a driver and could – you know, people – it just – the first few weeks worked out amazingly where, you know, I had heads of political parties sending their cars to pick me up at my hotel and then taking me out for the day. And it was sort of fortuitous from that.
And what was your hope in going to Pakistan?
My hope was always that I would be able to establish myself as a foreign correspondent. I had no experience. I had about 4 articles to my name. No one was going to send me to Pakistan besides this foundation. No magazine was going to say, okay, you know, you've got experience, you go. So I hoped that I would be able to stumble upon interesting stories and at the end potentially be able to even write a book. I had, you know, no idea of the kind of stories that I would stumble into or that the sort of experiences would, you know, make for the book that it did.
Nicholas Schmidl, do join us, 800-433-8850. His new book is titled To Live or To Perish Forever. Tell me about that title.
The title is borrowed from a 1933 treatise written by a young Indian Muslim. This was in the run-up to the creation or the independence of India and the creation of independent Pakistan. And this young Indian Muslim wrote a treatise titled Now or Never, Are We to Live or Perish Forever? And in this, he proposes the idea of Pakistan. And he proposes the idea of Pakistan as an acronym representing the Northwest territories of what was then United India, the P for Punjab, the A for Afghania, or the Northwest Frontier Province, the K for Kashmir. I don't know why they didn't believe in I's. They went straight to S for Sindh and then T-A-N for Baluchistan. And, you know, conveniently, this also, Pakistan in Urdu also means land of the pure. Pak means pure. So this was the basis of, I mean, this is really the ideological basis of Pakistan.
And you found yourself looking for what kinds of stories?
Initially, I have my background. I started a master's program in political philosophy. Initially, I was very interested in sort of the grand stories of identity and you know, what is the meaning of Pakistan and these sorts of questions. Eventually, I realized that those were far less interesting than the stories about people and sort of how they were interacting within Pakistan and within its problems and you know, it's sort of its dynamism. So. Increasingly, I also became very interested in trying to unravel and understand a little bit more about what this sort of jihadi ideology and the Pakistani Taliban were all about, and befriended a radical cleric who sort of opened up this world to me.
He opened the world to you?
That's right. So there was this guy named Abdul Rashid Ghazi, who was the head of the Red Mosque in Islamabad. And in the spring of 2006, I met Abdulrashid Ghazi for the first time. And it would be the beginning of a really amazing and unique and fascinating experience and relationship where I met him probably 6 or 7 times before he was ultimately killed by Pakistani commandos in July of 2007.
Tell us about the Red Mosque.
The Red Mosque was a literally Pepto-Bismol colored mosque, a very non-threatening color scheme in the middle of Islamabad, that had been founded by Ghazi's father in the early 1960s at the time of that Islamabad was founded itself. And the mosque had always been a sort of way station for jihadis transiting into Afghanistan during the 80s, into Kashmir during the 90s, and then back again into Afghanistan from 2001 on. And in early 2007, the mosque had gone from becoming a place where sermons were given praising Osama bin Laden and such to a place where vigilantes were emanating from the mosque, kidnapping brothel owners, kidnapping policemen, standing in front of the mosque with old sort of rusty garden tools protecting the mosque. There were banners draped off the sides, you know, saying al-jihad, al-jihad. And it was, I mean, it was an amazing, it was also amazing because Islamabad is such a quiet place normally. A friend of mine dubbed it low self-esteemabad because it's so quiet, there nothing happens. And so to have this jihadi headquarters a mile from the house was a gift as a journalist, was also a bit scary, increasingly, as a husband.
Nicholas Schmidl, his new book about his 22 months in Pakistan is titled To Live or to Perish Forever. Do join us, 800-433-8850. If you've just joined us, Nicholas Schmidl is here in the studio. He's got a brand new book out. It's titled To Live or to Perish Forever. In it, he writes about his 2 tumultuous years in Pakistan, where he went with his wife in 2006. Tell us about your wife and what she was doing while you're writing.
Right. Well, she, my wife Ricky, she's an artist. She's a photographer, sort of at an amateurish level, but she just loves it. And so when we first arrived there, she just went around taking pictures, drawing, painting, doing all this kind of
interacting. Free to move.
Free to move everywhere.
Okay.
She was working also with some NGOs in the Pakistani Kashmir that had been affected by, in the areas that had been affected by the earthquake in 2005. But she increasingly became a little bored. And after about 6 months, you know, she started looking for something else to do. And she thought, well, I'm in a Muslim country. I should try and learn something about Islam. And at this time is when she enrolled in the International Islamic University. And she became the only non-Muslim American to ever enroll there and spent the next year and a half working on a master's that the night that we were kicked out, she was studying for her Arabic exam and saying, I'm not going to leave. And I said, I don't think you have a choice. She said, I have an Arabic exam tomorrow. I've been studying for 6 months. I said, you don't have a choice. We're getting, the police are downstairs. She also, and we also, we traveled together at times. We didn't travel much sort of to the – I always said that west of Islamabad, towards the northwest frontier province, I'll go there by myself. We did take one trip up to Shandur, which is way up in the mountains, to see the world's highest polo field. She also, though, became – she was the nutritionist at the five-star hotel in Islamabad, which earned us two free gym memberships.
I see.
Which also opened up to her another network of high-level connections that ultimately, on the night that we were almost deported – bought us 48 hours of leeway.
And was she in any way restricted in her movements?
Increasingly, she became a little bit restricted in her movements. And as I mentioned a second ago about the Red Mosque, she used to, when we first got there, she used to go jogging outside, you know, wearing long sleeves and wearing long pants. But then as the Red Mosque became a little bit more assertive, there were rumors that some of the young jihadis that were there were talking about that they were going to start throwing acid on women who weren't covered. So Ricky stopped exercising outside. She traveled she didn't travel as freely as I did. She could go to Karachi, she could go to Lahore. She moved very freely around Islamabad. She drove by herself. I mean, it wasn't a big deal in that sense. And in Islamabad, she became very, very comfortable. In fact, the final thing that she was doing, and right as we were kicked out, was that she'd just been commissioned to start hosting a reality TV show in Urdu in which she was making over Pakistani women. So she had kind of taken Pakistan by storm. And so the night that we were kicked out, I tried to capture that moment and to tell people, you don't understand, here's a blonde Jersey girl who's saying, no, not over my dead body am I going to leave Pakistan. So she really, I mean, I think that she misses Pakistan every bit as much, if not more, than I do.
Interesting. Now, when you made that first of several trips to the northwest frontier province, what was the situation at the time?
The situation, I went to Banu, which is a town right outside of North Waziristan, on the border of North Waziristan, in, I believe it was April or May of 2006. Very, very tense. The instructions that I had from my journalist friend, who was from South Waziristan, on the way down to the area was, don't speak English in public. So, you know, I wore local clothes. I sort of sat in the back seat with window shields covering the windows as we drove through Banu. Very, very tense, but still no physical Taliban presence in the streets during the daytime. And so we spent a few days there and met a number of people who were saying, you know, who were telling me that, in fact, the army's operations against the Taliban were perpetuating the Taliban at that point, that the collateral damage was killing people who weren't necessarily with the Taliban, but then they were vowing to take up arms after that. So you could see the beginning of the Talibanization, if you will, spreading outside of the tribal areas into the so-called settled areas of the Northwest Frontier Province.
What did that look like in terms of behaviors?
You saw, I mean, the Banu doesn't look, the streetscape looks very similar to the streetscape in North Waziristan and looks very similar to the streetscapes of southern and eastern Afghanistan. Women in burqas, men, you know, long beards. But this tradition, this culture has predated the Taliban. I mean, the notion that burqas only came with the Taliban is unfortunately not true. Burqas have been part of Afghan culture for centuries. But there was very little police presence. And that was what was most frightening, is that in the evening time, after we finished dinner, it was around 11 o'clock, we were driving back to the hotel. And there were like six people that we saw on the street for the five-mile drive from the dinner to the hotel. And all of them were carrying personal weapons. And it was dark, and it was just – you just got the sense that it was – I mean, there was this frontier town, and you could see that the government's control was slipping by the day.
Did you ever carry a personal weapon?
I didn't know. I thought it could have been a good idea at times, but was always told that it wouldn't be.
You've written in this book that you regard the most underreported development in Pakistan in recent years as the ideological battle raging between or among religious conservatives on the legitimacy of the Taliban. Give us some of the background on that.
Well, when the Taliban first started making their presence felt, the religious leadership, the traditional religious leadership, exemplified by the traditional religious political parties, Jamaat-e-Islami, Jamaat-e-Ulama-Islami, these groups that in 2002 formed a single electoral bloc and won about 11% of the vote, they were always seen as being pro-Taliban. And yet as the Taliban started emerging, they were threatened by the Taliban. The Taliban were saying that you guys are still in cahoots with the government. And so this was the divide where you saw big religious leaders not sure whether to condone or condemn. Condemn and their lives were in danger. Condone and they sort of became their legitimacy within the Pakistan's political framework became endangered. So it was a very, very fragile moment. And there was this one individual who I profile in the book named Maulana Fazlur Rahman, who's the head of one of these big pro-Taliban parties. And he, one of his friends said to me at one point that, you know, the problem with Maulana Fazlur Rahman is that the government thinks that he's the Taliban's man. The Taliban thinks that he's the government's man, and yet he's no one's man. And he's stuck like a, he's made like a sandwich and he's stuck in the middle. And no one really envied that position. So you've got this big bearded guy who used to be close to the Taliban who just has sort of lost his influence.
So what did that mean to his followers, for example?
You saw a split. I think that his followers were increasingly, his followers were leaning away from him towards the Taliban. You almost had this break within his political party between the sort of the IRA and the real IRA. And you had leading members of his political party saying that, you know, Maulana has sold out to the government. He's just, you know, he's taking money from Musharraf. It was just, it became very dirty. And you saw these divisions emerging. This is kind of, this was the idea of the New York Times Magazine story that ultimately got me kicked out, this profile of what we called the next gen Taliban that was no longer beholden to the traditional religious authority, no longer beholden to the traditional tribal authority, and in some sense, no longer even beholden to the Pakistan's intelligence agencies, which had created them years ago.
So when you wrote that story, did you believe that Musharraf's government was in charge or that the Taliban was in charge?
Well, there was one afternoon that I spent in the Swat Valley in October of 2007 in which it was very clear to me that the government's writ had completely collapsed. And that afternoon, myself and a local journalist from Swat spent the day in the company of Maulana Fazlullah, who is the head of the Pakistani Taliban, and I'm the last Western journalist to have met him. And this was in October of 2007. He invited us to his compound for the day, where there were about 10 or 15,000 people all there for the Friday prayers, and then for what they billed as a quote-unquote special event after the Friday prayers. It turned out that that special event would be a public lashing. And so to get there that day, myself and the journalists, we had two choices. To go from, it was across the Swat River from Mingora, which is the main city in Swat. And we could either drive all the way around the river and drive through a number of villages that were connected or that were all sort of under Maulana Fazlullah's control, but thus run the risk that one of his low-ranking lieutenants didn't get the message that here comes the American. Or we could park beside the river, board into a carriage attached to a zip line, and go careening across the Swat River and land in the middle of this compound. So clearly the second option actually seemed the safer one at the time, and that's how we got in. And Fazlullah immediately came over to us, welcomed us, said that, you all are free to walk around the compound for the day, make yourselves at home. In the meantime, there's jihadi poems playing on the PA system. There's men walking around with rocket launchers and Kalashnikovs over their shoulders, long hair, floppy, traditional caps. This is a perfect example of the kind of hospitality you see in this area. I nudged my translator and I said, tell Maulana Fazlullah that I really appreciate the offer, but frankly, you know, these people they're going to tear us to shreds. And I had dyed my hair. I was wearing local clothes. I looked passably maybe as someone that wasn't, not as a glaring American, but not someone from that area necessarily. And Maulana Fazlullah's response was, he turned to both of his shoulders and he picked his right-hand man, his right-hand bodyguard, and he said, okay, you guard the American for the day. And so for the day, we had Maulana Fazlullah's bodyguard as we watched this public lashing.
Public lashing. Of whom? For what?
Of three young men for allegedly participating in a kidnapping plot. This was at a time when the Taliban had done something, sort of had come to power very systematically in Swat. After the destruction of the Red Mosque that we were describing earlier, the Taliban in Swat launched this campaign against the Pakistani military in Swat, suicide bombings, ambushes, etc., totally destabilizing the area. The army and the police then said, okay, we're done with this. We're going to go back and sit in the barracks because we're getting whacked out here. And in that vacuum of power, criminals, kidnappers, bandits emerged and started grabbing people and kidnapping people. So one night, there was a rumor that three women were being taken over the hills towards Afghanistan by some kidnappers, and Milanovlav's Lula rallied a bunch of his men. They jumped in pickup trucks, this is according to their folklore, and chased down these kidnappers and arrested them. And then on this particular day when we were there was when they were conducting the lashings of them. And so these three guys were frog marched up onto this public platform, laid down, face down, and proceeded to receive 25, 20, and 15 lashings, you know, sort of relative to their participation in the crime. And it was amazing to sit there and to watch these 15,000 people that had gathered literally chanting out the number in Pashto, the number of lashings as they were counting down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, like the final seconds of a basketball game. But it expressed this deep desire, too, for something like justice. And the government's writ had collapsed. There were no police. There were no courts. And so the Taliban just simply filled that vacuum.
And you watched.
And I proceeded to watch the whole time, taking notes, thinking to myself that, you know what, when this gets published, someone's not going to be happy that I was standing here at this scene. But yeah, we watched. It was such an amazing amalgamation of people too. I was standing there taking notes at one point, and this man walks up to me with a big beard and a gun, and looks over my shoulder and asks me in perfect English, "Who do I write for?" And I told him that I was working for the New York Times Magazine, and asked him. I turned around and said, "Well, how do you speak such great English?" And he said, "Well, you know, I'm from SWAT, but I lived in the States for many years. I was living in Louisiana and Texas at barbecue joints. And then when Milana Fazlullah took over SWAT, I decided to come back because this is where my heart was." And so that was, that was a sort of look into this profile of this new generation of Taliban.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Were you even with his bodyguard with you? Were you not concerned about yourself?
Again, I probably should have been more concerned, but I wasn't at the time. It was so surreal. It was so, I just kind of didn't, I mean, I wish, during that moment, I wish that my mind had been, was a movie camera. I wish that I could go back and play it. It was just so surreal that as the three pickup trucks came speeding out of the hills, kicking up this huge cloud of dust. And these three pickup trucks were the ones that were carrying those who were about to be lashed and those who were going to do the lashings. And they kick up this huge cloud of dust, cut into the middle of the circle of people sitting around the platform, parked next to the platform. And I thought, this is it. The tall Arab with the beard and the $50 million price tag on his head is going to walk out. I mean, it was nothing would have surprised me at that point.
Did the three who were lashed survive?
They did. In fact, the youngest one who received the 15 lashings, he was visibly the most shaken. He was shaking, he was crying, etc. But in all honesty, the lashings themselves, while vile and while certainly, you know, condemnable, it wasn't that they were that bad, in fact. And if you give me the choice of 15 lashings or 15 years in a Pakistani jail, I probably am going to take the 15 lashings.
What did they use to conduct the lashings?
It was a leather belt about 2 feet long, kind of like the width and thickness of a beaver tail almost. The guys, now this raised another question, is that the guys who did the lashings had their faces covered with ski masks, looked much more militant, and left you to wonder whether they were not from there, whether they were Uzbeks or whether they were Arab militants who were actually the ones that were carrying out the sort of the punishment. I mean, they had this very executioner look to them.
Were women in the crowd watching as well?
There were no women there. Milana Fazlullah had actually banned women from being in public using his illegal FM radio station. So they were not in the markets. They were certainly not at the mosque that day. Their presence was really limited to their homes at that point.
Most of the time, or just because of that lashing?
Well, the lashing was a little bit out of town, but the women really didn't come out very much. And one of the residents in SWAT was joking to me and said that, you know, we kind of wish that the women could come out, he says, because we get saddled with all the shopping chores, you know, whereas the women used to come out during the day and get food for the evening. Now we have to not only go out and get food for dinner, but we also have to pick up bras and things like that. And, you know, he said that there's a lot more work trying to keep our women folk, you know, behind, as Milana Fazlullah is instructed, behind closed doors.
And your wife could manage the fact that here you were out there participating, being part of what was happening. She was back home.
She was back home. She was getting a little stir crazy too.
I would think so.
And as I was out traveling, I mean, she could still move around Islamabad, but as I was out traveling and reporting this story in the Northwest Frontier Province a good bit in the fall of 07, I finally, she'd been wanting a cat for the longest time, and I finally went away for about a week and came back, and I'm allergic to cats, and I came back, and there was this kitten parading across our bed, and I thought, all right, you can have the cat. I understand.
Where were you when Benazir Bhutto was assassinated?
I was in a town called Charsada, which is just outside of Peshawar. And it was an amazing day too. I had interviewed that afternoon the head of this Pashtun party called the Awami National Party, and his party was the only one that was still conducting nightly political rallies. And he told me that, look, our political rallies haven't been affected. And sure enough, that night as he's standing up there, the announcement that Benazir Bhutto had been killed forced them to cut the party, the rally.
Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by NPR stations, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Newspapers are in trouble. Many websites, blogs, and cable news shows are dominated by opinion. Are we losing impartial reporting? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Alex Jones, author of Losing the News. He's also director of Harvard's Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And just before the break, you, Nicholas Schmidl, were talking about the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. What was the reaction to her assassination?
It was total shock. I mean, it shocked the nation. And the night that we were at this political rally and someone in the front row interrupted the leader of the Awami National Party, and this was the guy who just 10 minutes earlier had been telling me that his political campaign won't be disrupted by the Taliban. And the person in the front row said, Esfandiar Saab, Benazir Bhutto has been assassinated. And here's this, you know, tall, 6'3", incredibly powerful man who just kind of dropped his head and stepped off the stage and looked like he was about to cry. And everyone at this political rally, there were no women there either. And everyone was just distraught and shocked, and people were you know, weeping. And you could see the way that Benazir Bhutto had, I mean, she had really transcended gender lines. And we've been talking a lot about gender. And really what applied for most Pakistani women just simply didn't apply to Benazir Bhutto. But in the days after this initial shock passed, it was just pure violence and very scary. And that night as we were leaving the political rally, driving back into Peshawar where we were staying, we got to the edge of the city and all the public buses were streaming and speeding out of the city because of the threat of rioters burning the buses. And right, sure enough, right when we first pulled into the city, there was a car that was burning, and people were throwing rocks and firing guns in the air, and the policeman said, do not go any further. He said, you know, this is, it's out of control, so we had to drive. We drove all the way around and eventually got to our hotel.
All right, let's open the phones first to Diane in Falls Church, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I want to know if you ever have conversations with these people about what does a future look like? What would an ideal future be? I mean, just having Sharia law and being religious, what do they see for dreams for their kids, for the kind of civic culture you'd have? Do you ever have conversations about visions, say, of the future?
That's a fantastic question. I wish I would have asked it more when I was there, in fact. People, the Taliban did talk a lot about the future, but as you mentioned, they talked about it in the sense of Sharia law, in the sense of removing vice from society, in the sense of removing American influence from Pakistani society. And the problem is that, as we've seen with the Taliban and SWAT, they talked all about Sharia, just give us Sharia and SWAT and we'll be happy. And then the government gave them Sharia and SWAT, and then before you knew it, they were conquering neighboring districts, trying to take more land. So it's really hard, I think, to gauge exactly what their ultimate ambitions are.
Do they? Is that a Western, more of a Western concept that we think thinking long terms about what do you want to be when you grow up and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I remember at one point, this is around the same time, me talking to a guy who was Neswar vendor. Neswar is a tobacco that people chew in the Northwest Frontier Province. And I asked him who he was going to vote for in the election in 2 weeks. And he said, my friend, I don't know what I'm going to have dinner for tonight. I'm not thinking about the election in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Brian in Kirkwood, Missouri. He says, what are we Americans failing to understand about the Taliban and the jihadi movement in Pakistan?
I think that the Taliban in Pakistan is unfortunately evolving at a rate that is becoming less and less manageable, in that the quote-unquote reconcilable elements of the Taliban, those guys who are just simply conservative bumpkins who want to keep their women, you know, behind closed doors but don't really pose a threat to national security of the United States, is increasingly becoming muddied by the effect that Al-Qaeda has had from its safe havens in Pakistan's tribal areas. So in my mind, actually, the Pakistani Taliban are significantly more influenced and affected by Al-Qaeda ideology compared to, say, the Afghan Taliban.
And how long has that been happening?
I think that it's been steadily happening since late 2001, when the top Al-Qaeda leaders fled Afghanistan and took up residence in North and South Waziristan and increasingly have spread throughout the country.
Here's another email, this one from Kirsten, who says, Pakistan is first and foremost a country of four main nationalities or ethnic, ruled by an army made up mostly of Punjabis, who are the dominant nations. People's loyalties are to their ethnic inheritance, and the Taliban is entirely Pashtun, who number 30 million in Pakistan, 15 million in Afghanistan. They never accepted the Durand Line, that is the official border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The current fight now is against the Pashtun. Why is the ethnic factor never factored in by the West?
That's a fantastic question. And in fact, I think that one of the themes of my book is the fact that ethnic politics are so often overlooked, and that this is a critical ingredient and element to understanding how Pakistani politics sort of play themselves out. The comment about people's loyalties being to their ethnicities first is also right on. I remember when I first got to Pakistan being stunned by the number of flags, non-Pakistani national flags that were everywhere. And, you know, I remember one of them, the flag of Jamaat-e Ulama Islam, it's just a simple black and white striped horizontal stripe. And I had been there in Pakistan for about a week, and I saw this flag and I thought, you know, if I ever become the head of a rogue pirate state somewhere in the South Pacific, that would definitely
That's
be my
flag.
That's the flag I want.
But what you're saying is each of these factions has its own flag.
That's right. And you only see Pakistani national flags in government buildings and sort of at the border. People don't fly Pakistani national flags like they fly the flags of their political parties.
Is that because they simply do not have respect for a central government?
They have respect for a central government. Their loyalties are just to their parties, their financial loyalties, their ideological loyalties. I think that when you see Pakistani nationalism, it's often in response to some perceived threat, which is how it is across the world, but particularly how it is in Pakistan. You see Pakistani nationalism when the Taliban were moving towards Islamabad 3 months ago. You saw people suddenly saying, we as Pakistanis need to stand up. And you see Pakistani nationalism vis-a-vis threats from India.
And let's go now to Auburn Hills, Michigan. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, I'm a Pakistani-American, and this is actually a very interesting topic to me. Mr. Nicholas has gone to Pakistan and tells that it's a very beautiful country and people are very hospitable. I thank him for that. The few things I would like to mention, one of the things you just were talking about the flag, being a Pakistani, I know a little bit more about that. In General Zia's time, before when Benazir's father was the president or prime minister, we could fly the flags anywhere we wanted. But we couldn't do that when the martial law, when Zia-ul-Haq came into power, because it was like more of a military symbol, the Pakistani flag became. But it was allowed to be flown, on special occasions like the 14th of August, when we have our Independence Day, or any political rallies where Pakistan was being promoted, you could fly the flag. That's one thing. For an outsider like an American or a European going back, like if I go to a gas station in America, I see an American flag. In Pakistan, you cannot see that. We don't do that normally. It's considered as disrespectful to our flag. You burn flags in America. We don't. We don't. We only burn flags in Pakistan for enemies of Pakistan or what we perceive to be. But my comment was, his book is very nice. I haven't read it, but I'm definitely going to go tonight and buy that. But Taliban is a very small story of what Pakistan is. One of your emails mentioned that there are four different ethnic groups. There are more than that, but the major ones are four. And it'll be me writing a book like in the 60s or in the 50s if I came as a journalist to America and wrote a book about Ku Klux Klan while I was residing in Mississippi. I think it's a similar kind of comparison I can do. Pakistani Taliban's are a problem to the masses of Pakistan. Like he was mentioning, there is a little less justice that is being served in the courts of Pakistan. We have dictators. We have had a rough history. But I appreciate him writing these things. But some of the things that you were shocked about are just cultural, because you went from America to a country where people don't fly flags. Your wife was able to run in the streets of Islamabad. I am from Islamabad, so I know when you are in a city circle or where people are slightly more inclined to a normal way of life. I think the Taliban's are slightly skewed towards the radical Islam.
All right, sir. And do you want to respond, Nicholas?
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, that I would be really interested to hear his perspectives on the KKK in Mississippi, for sure. He raises a great point about over-reporting the Taliban. And in fact, after we left under threat of deportation in January of 2008 for writing this story about the Taliban, I really wanted to go back to Pakistan. And I wanted to go back to Pakistan and I wanted to write a story about Sufism which in my mind has the number. The Taliban might have the guns, but the Sufis really have the numbers. And they are, if you want to understand the heart of the majority of Pakistanis and what their sort of Islamic beliefs are, most of them tend towards this very eccentric brand of Islam that emphasizes one's individual relationship with God and not through the mullah and not through the mosque necessarily. And so when I went back to Pakistan, I was given a visa, and I went back to Pakistan in August of 2008 to write a story for Smithsonian Magazine about this great Sufi festival in Sindh. And unfortunately, midway through that trip, began the same people, I believe, who were involved in kicking me out the first time, began calling, saying that they wanted to meet me. And then when we began checking to see if those people, who those people were, found out that those people didn't exist. So we had a guy saying he was a newspaper editor, and we had a guy saying he was an interior ministry official. About a half an hour after that, stories began appearing in the press that I had been kidnapped. And when you're reading stories about your own kidnapping, it's about the time where you stand up and say, time out, I'm good, I'm done, I'm leaving. And eventually, after about 24 hours, asked for help from the U.S. Embassy and was ultimately driven to the airport in a bulletproof car. And so my thought to myself and to my wife is that if I have to be taken out of a country in a bulletproof car, then we can probably say that we're good on that for a while.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The clear message being you were not welcome back in the country.
That's right. And this, what was so frightening about going back in August of 2008 was that, as we were discussing earlier in my presence and my witnessing this Taliban lashing, is that I never felt unsafe. I felt like I was a guest and I was welcome. When I went back in August, now my visa for me to go back after having been sort of semi-deported once had to be cleared by all the top military and intelligence officials. So I knew that at the upper echelon, everyone said, we don't have a problem with him coming back. And yet at the lower level or at the mid-level, someone wasn't pleased. And for that person to have been able to sow the kind of confusion and fear that they did for those 3 days after the story started appearing in the press and in all the local newspapers that I'd been kidnapped, was, which I think in some ways is an unfortunate example of the sort of the decentralization of power in Pakistan and to some extent the sort of schizophrenia of the state, if you will.
And to Rochester, New York, good morning, Keith.
Yes, I wanted to ask pointedly, in the tribal areas, the Taliban have been destroying the ancient traditional leadership and command systems that these various peoples have relied on. I've seen pictures of their hanging and burning the bodies of leaders who would not fall into line with the Taliban. I'm just wondering how this factors in with your observations and the future of what we're going to have to put up with the Taliban.
That's a great point. In fact, while the Anbar awakening was happening in Iraq, and as U.S. military officials were able to start turning Iraqi Sunni tribes to help them fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, based in Pakistan's tribal areas, were taking notes. And to preempt this from happening, they began, as you mentioned, knocking off and killing and assassinating all these top tribal leaders. And this actually had happened earlier than 2006 with the Anbar awakening, but it really accelerated. And now, as you suggest, particularly in the areas where the Taliban are strongest, North Waziristan, South Waziristan, there is no tribal structure left to stand up to them. And so this gets back to the point earlier I was mentioning about how this emergent new next generation of Taliban are no longer under the control of whether it be the tribal authorities, the traditional religious authorities, or the intelligence agencies.
And finally, to Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Good morning, Frank.
Hello, Diane. Listen, I just wanted to make a quick comment. You know, like, this has been going on with the Taliban for years now, but it reflects on the religious differences between people that just can't get along with each other. All that the Taliban that they're purported to do seems like it goes against what the Muslim religion stands for. Has the Muslim religion as a whole umbrella, have they ever disowned these people, disenfranchised them in any way whatsoever?
They have, and in fact, several top leaders of some relatively fundamentalist political parties disowned and condemned the leaders of the Red Mosque in early 2007 as they were kidnapping brothel owners and police officers. And Abdul Rashid Ghazi of the Red Mosque, his response to me was, go ahead, let them. It doesn't matter. They're irrelevant. All their young foot soldiers are with us now. Mm. And so this is when you saw, like I said, this gap emerging.
And now you're off to Nigeria.
I am.
To write about.
To write, I'm going to do a story for the New York Times Magazine and talking about sort of political and economy and kidnapping culture in Nigeria to some extent.
Be careful.
I will.
Nicholas Schmidl. His new book is titled To Live or to Perish Forever. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.